you. So yes, welcome back. So yes, tonight we're in the last session of exploring this book, which is called The Inconceivable Emancipation by Sangharakshita, who founded this movement. And it's a commentary on this book called the Vimalakirti Nadesha. So I'm giving a talk on a commentary about this book. And that's very much in keeping with the Buddhist tradition, really. If you haven't been here, I'll just sort of recap a little bit about this book, Vimalakirti Nadesha. And Nadesha means teaching, and Vimalakirti is a man. In fact, he's not an ordinary man. What we've been learning about is that he's a bodhisattva, somebody who is committed to helping all beings achieve enlightenment. So he's an interesting character because he appears as a layman. You know, he's got a family, he runs a business, so he appears as a very ordinary character. But he's extraordinary in how he operates, really. So we know that he's got magical powers, for example. He can do things like, open up his house so that 32,000 or thousands upon thousands of advanced spiritual practitioners can sort of sit in his house. So he's definitely a sort of magical character. We know that in the book he becomes sick, but there's no suffering in his sickness. He's become sick so he can teach sort of very effectively to many people. So I think I'll read you a little bit about him in terms of how he sort of comes across, just to give us a flavour, and also to give us a flavour of this text, because it's unlike ordinary kind of text as well. So I'll give you a little bit of flavour of Vimalakirti. So it says, he was liberated through the transcendence of wisdom. Having integrated his realisation with skill in liberative technique, he was expert in knowing the thoughts and actions of living beings, knowing the strength or weakness of their faculties, and being gifted with unrivaled eloquence. He taught the Dharma appropriately to each. Having applied himself energetically to the Mahayana, he understood it and accomplished his tasks with great finesse. He lived with the deportment of a Buddha, and his superior intelligence was as wide as an ocean. He was praised, honoured and commended by all the Buddhas and was respected by Indra, Brahma and all the Lokapalas. In order to develop living beings with his skill in liberative technique, he lived in the great city of Varsali. So that's one section. And I'll tell you about what he wore and how he lived. So it goes like this. He wore the white clothes of the layman, yet lived impeccably like a religious devotee. He lived at home, but remained aloof from the realm of desire, the realm of pure matter, and the immaterial realm. He had a son, a wife, and female attendants, yet always maintained continence. He appeared surrounded by servants, yet lived in solitude. He appeared to be adorned with ornaments, yet always was endowed with the auspicious signs and marks. He seemed to eat and drink, yet always took nourishment from the taste of meditation. He made his appearance at the fields of sports and in the casinos, but his aim was always to mature those people who were attached to games and gambling. He visited the fashionable heterodox teachers, yet always kept unswerving loyalty to the Buddha. He understood the mundane and transcendental sciences and esoteric practices, yet always took pleasure in the delights of the Dharma. And it goes on to say basically how he, you know, appeared like this, but was like this. So he's basically, he's a very sort of compassionate. He goes on to say that he went to all kinds of places, to brothels, to schools, to teach, to give people what they really needed. So he's a deeply compassionate, deeply caring for the well-being of others. And at the same time, later on in the book, you've got him challenging his fellow practitioners. So he's very compassionate to sort of ordinary beings who need the Dharma. And yet his fellow practitioners, he's very challenging, almost rebuking them at times. And we'll sort of come on to why a bit later on. So he's definitely a fascinating character, but you can't pin him down. You can say he's a bit like this, but then he's also like that. And also the book itself is strange too, because scholars don't actually know who actually wrote the book. So we know it was written down. It's part of the Mahayana school, which was a second great phase of Buddhism. And in that second phase, unlike the first phase, things were written down. In the first phase of Buddhism, where the Buddha was teaching, everything was conveyed orally. And none of his actual teachings were written down until several hundred years later. But in the second phase, everything was written down. So someone or some people composed this text, but we don't know who. So yes, it's quite an interesting, he's an interesting character, and the text has a fascinating, interesting, unknown origins as well. So I see it definitely as a text full of paradoxes. And it's interesting because you might have got a little flavour of it there, that it sort of has a repetitious sort of a feel to it. It repeats things and it gives you different sort of perspectives, but it's kind of quite repetitious and sometimes quite long in its descriptions as well. And it has an effect. It's really interesting sort of reading it or listening to it, particularly, I mean, it's a couple of hundred pages, the actual text, but reading it and listening to it with the sort of repetition somehow has an interesting effect on the mind. And certainly for me, I find that it's a reading text like that, the sort of Mahayana text, somehow I sort of emerge, just with a broader perspective, really. It sort of somehow loosens my sense of how I see the world. I was here a few weeks ago and I was washing up with somebody that was at the class, and she said, "Oh, I came in just to have a bit of a meditation, really, and I thought I'd stay for the talk. And I felt, you know, right, but now I feel really quiet. Don't really know how I feel. I didn't really understand everything I heard, but I feel radically different from how I came in." And I thought that's part of how it impacts. It somehow just has an effect without you realising sometimes. And I was thinking about, we kind of need, every now and again, we need to... it's very good, isn't it, if something sort of comes into our lives and has an effect on us. And sometimes those things happen because we've sought them out, we've sort of cultivated them, and other times it just happens. It's a bit like walking down the road, I sometimes think, and you're not expecting anything, and suddenly you have this sort of waft of a scent, a very beautiful scent that's from a flower or a bush somewhere, and you look around and think, where did that come from? But it has this effect on the mind. Or you can cultivate it, you can go towards it, such as deciding you go to a concert and you think, yes, I want to go to a concert and I want to hear this music. And it's sometimes in the middle of the experience you realise you've been transported away. You thought you knew what you was going to experience, but actually the experience itself is quite different. And you come out and think, I feel very different to how I came in. So that's kind of the effects of Mahayana texts. I was thinking about my first experience of something happening, so interrupting my usual way of perceiving and thinking about the world. And I was 6 years old, and I'd fallen off the climbing frames at school. And in those days, it was concrete. They didn't have all that nice surfaces they have now. So I'd fallen off the climbing frames and banged my head, and I must have been slightly concussed. But again, I can't remember any adults or anybody coming to help. So I was on my way home, and I was walking down the road thinking, I feel really strange. But what was strange was, yes, I was probably a bit dizzy, but what was really strange was that I realised I was looking at my environment as if for the very first time. It was as if I'd been planted there suddenly. And I'd walked down that road often, but suddenly I was really looking at it. And I didn't like what I saw. What I saw, in fact, partly as well, there was a really terrible smell. There was a dog that had died, apparently. In those days, in the East End, you'd get that. You'd get sort of dogs who died and people just leave them. And it wasn't that long ago either. And I sort of remember smelling that and thinking, oh, that's really a horrible smell. And then I looked around and it was all very grey. That's what I remember feeling. Well, seeing it, how grey it was, and seeing people, I really looked at people's faces, and everyone looked miserable. I couldn't remember anybody smiling. So I was struck by that, and then looking again, and then seeing sort of racist graffiti as well. And I didn't understand it, but I knew it was hostile. I knew it had something to do with me. So the combination of all those things I was jolted out of my sort of usual way. I walk down the road every day and I wouldn't even think twice, and suddenly I knew this, something wasn't right with this environment I was in. And I resolved then that I would find a different kind of way of living. I sort of knew that I would find a different way of living and being. So that's a sort of negative experience that actually had a positive effect, because it sort of started me, I feel, on a quest, really. So, well, if I don't like this, then what is it that I'm looking for? What is it that I want? What is beauty? If I think this is ugly, well, what would beauty look like in my world? So it's very important, I think, to have these experiences that sort of jolts us out of our sort of ordinary, everyday things that we take for granted, the way we've constructed our lives. So, yes, I've said the way we construct our lives, but what do we think about that? So my question is, well, how do we construct our world? And maybe, there is an assumption there, a view there, that we do construct our world. So you might not agree with that. So the first thing is, I guess, do we construct our world? Do you construct your world? And if so, how? So that's a question for you to have a think about. How many of you think you do construct your world? Put your hands up. Okay, so more than half, but not everybody, okay? So those who do, in what ways might you construct?
I kind of like to construct it to my taste.
Okay, all right. Okay, yeah. Things that you like, so you want, there's things that you like, so you want those in your life, yeah? Okay. Yeah? So you're saying that, say that again, so you're saying that when joy...
The joy issues from you rather than joy coming to you.
Okay, so you feel that actually you sort of, your positive states has an impact, basically. It doesn't necessarily come to you, it's just that you see the world that way, so that's what you experience, okay? All right, any others?
I think I only partly construct.
Okay.
There are choices that I know I make.
Yeah.
I think quite freely. My preferences, mm-hmm. may spawn from my haircut to being here tonight.
Yes, yes.
I know that there are influences in there, but they are my own.
Right, yes.
And then there are a whole set of things, and sometimes they can be quite significant, that I do because I have to.
Right.
Because I ought to.
Yes, yes.
To meet other people's expectations.
Right, yes.
And I have come to appreciate those things and to accept them.
Mm-hmm.
But would I sometimes want to get rid of them or not do them at all or sort of change them at all? Yes, I would.
Right, yes, yes.
But I suppose they've become like habits now. Mm. They are part of my world. Mm. They are part of the construction of my world. Mm. So if I got rid of them, let's say, what would I be missing?
Okay. So do we? Do some of us resonate with what she was saying? Because I really relate to that. So what you're saying is that, well, you freely construct things. You know that you choose. For example, you choose to come here to meditate. You might choose to do whatever you decided to do at the weekend. Those are choices you actively make. And other things feels like things you have to do, yeah? So there's expectations, whether it's through work, jobs, family, responsibilities, feels that you just have to do them. And actually some of those things, you might, if you felt you had free choice, might not do them, yes? Is that what you're saying, isn't it? Might not do them, and other things you're not sure about. So it feels like partially constructed, yeah? Partially constructed. Freedom is just another word for nothing else to lose. Okay, so we can sit with that and see. So that's quite interesting. So we feel it's partially constructed. Well, if I put the question another way, what if I said, what influences or determines the way we operate and experience the world? So what influences and determines the way we operate in and experience the world? Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I just think the way that you've been, like your upbringing, is completely different to someone else's.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like the society, the environment around you.
Absolutely. So, society, yes. Yeah, and there's lots of different aspects of society, yes. What are the different aspects of society? What do we mean? When we say society, what are we talking about?
Education.
Culture.
Values.
Mm-hmm. Come on to that, yes. Religion, class, gender, race, all of those, yes? That's kind of like economics, definitely politics, all of those things sort of a part of what we mean by society. So absolutely, society has an impact on us. And it's kind of interesting because it's collective. So for example, I'm a black woman, I'm a black woman, you know, so both those things, so I relate as a woman, my experience therefore will connect in some ways with some other women, yes, around some things, so we sort of agree with that, yeah? However, it's also very personal, isn't it, because how I then relate to that and the kind of the meanings I make of my experiences as a woman may be very different to how somebody else then interprets their experience. There might be common threads, but it also can be very, very different. But it's collective in that, and we've seen it, haven't we, in our society, that groups of, say, women have come together and thought, actually, this is our experience. We're not happy about certain aspects of our experience, in history this is, like not being able to vote, for example. Let's change that. And then it's, you know, through collective effort, it's changed. So there's a kind of improvement in some of the collective experience, which then impacts on the personal as well, to some extent, yes? So it's collective and it's personal, some of those societal things. And race is the same. There was a period of history, a very dark period of history, where it was completely sanctioned to have slavery. It was thought a good thing. So in churches and education, that's what they taught, and everyone believed that that's just how life is constructed. A lot of people went along with it until, again, groups of people got together and saw the sort of the suffering that was caused and realised it was based on ignorance, and went on an educational sort of campaign and helped people see it differently. So that kind of slavery, at least, was abolished. So do we see that collective experiences really do impact on the personal? And then we talked about some personal, very personal, which is our family conditioning as well, and the experience we have growing up, education as well, sort of crosses the collective and the personal, doesn't it? You know, sort of how we're educated. And then there are some things that are just very intrinsic to the fact that we have a body, you know, and that's, you know, our biology and our genetics. And science is still sort of figuring out some, you know, the way sort of our genetics sort of then has a, they've been exploring it for ages actually, but they still haven't, there's nothing definitive that's come out of it, I don't think, you know, about how our genetics sort of really play a part, but they do seem to play a part in our experience. So, so in a way, what the Buddha said was, in a way, all those things that we've mentioned can be under the heading of our conditioning. They're just things that we're conditioned by. And so before all the studies of, you know, psychology and economics and gender and all those things, the Buddha saw that we were impacted by our conditioning. And he was able to teach with that in mind. So, for example, in India in his day, and it still happens in India, they have a very rigid caste system. And if you're in the lower caste or even out excluded from the caste system, you were called untouchables in those days. And, you know, people really were shunned, really, just from being themselves. They were shunned and treated very harshly. So when, and the Buddha really responded to this because he didn't, he refused to obey the caste system in terms of his how he founded his movement, how he founded the order, and everybody, all castes were admitted to his order, and he refused to have any sort of acknowledgement of that in with other fellow practitioners. But also, you see it in the way he taught people as well. So if he had somebody came to him who were from a low caste background, he was very sensitive to the fact that they would have a low self-worth, for example, and he would teach with them in that in mind so that it would find their sort of innate dignity and connect with their sort of innate potential. And the same with people that were high caste as well, who were Brahmins, who were interested in his teachings. He would see that they had a real sense of superiority and thought they were better than most people. And again, he talked to that and sort of helped them see that actually they would be respected and honoured, not through their birth, circumstances of their birth, but through their qualities. And so encourage them to develop their qualities. So the Buddha was very sort of aware of society, if you like, societal conditioning and its impact on us. But Buddhism went much further than, you know, just sort of analysing society in that way. Because what Buddhism did is, and what the Buddha did is help us see that much of how we perceive the world and construct the world is dependent on our views. Yeah, so views. So I was thinking that you get people who spend, well, some of you might, spend a lot of time sort of looking at the world through one prism. So it might be, you might be really interested in politics, for example, so you know a lot about politics or economics or science or even literature. You know, there's different prisms in which we can see the world. And if you're really mindful and really reflective, you're able to see how these prisms sort of connect with each other, and you see that actually there's not just one way of looking at the world, there's myriad ways of looking at the world. But what the Buddha said, what the Buddha tried to do was actually go sort of beneath all of those perceptions, if you like, all those prisms, and look at what was actually driving the whole show. And he was really clear that to transform the world, because if you're a scientist, you think, well, actually, to really make a difference in the world, science might be the answer. And if you're an artist, you think art's the answer. And if you're an economist, you think, you know, economy, you know, is the answer. So you kind of, you know, have all these different ways. But the Buddha actually said, actually, really, to transform the world, we need to alleviate a much deeper level of suffering and get at the root, really, get at the root that produces all these myriads of views that actually conflict often with each other. So he said that we have wrong views. We have fundamentally wrong views of the way the world is. And wrong as in, not in the sense of, you know, there's wrong views, and I'll talk about right views as well, but not wrong as in bad views and good views, but wrong as in incomplete, distorted, one-sided, yes? So they're wrong in that sense. So there we have three fundamental wrong views, and one of them is permanent impermanence. So we see the world, and we want it to be permanent, yeah? And yet, we know it's impermanent. And certainly, living in London now, you're kind of much more sensitive to that with all the things going on. We also want to, we see ourselves as fixed beings. We feel that there's an ongoing continuity, like how I was today is going to be similar to how I am, you know, next year and in 5 years' time and 5 years ago. And Buddhism says, well, no, we are not fixed. We're not fixed or separate selves. And we also think, another fundamental wrong view is that we think we can get ultimate satisfaction from the world as we currently construct it. So we're constantly searching, whether it's the job or the house or the partner or the, you know, whatever it is, success. We're constantly searching for this thing. It's kind of elusive. We get it for a while when we accomplish something or somebody praises us. And then next thing we know, it sort of slips from our grasp. And again, it's because the view is that the world is satisfactory, just got to keep searching. And Buddhism says, actually, it's unsatisfactory. The world as we currently see it. So these kind of views, they're not sort of specific to the views we might have about politics or gender or whatever, our family. These are sort of existential, universal views. These are views that every person who's ever lived on this planet have had in some way. And they're driven by the fact that we want to, I think we were saying it, some of us were saying it earlier, we want to avoid pain. We want to avoid pain and we seek pleasure. We want to avoid pain and we seek pleasure. So we're constantly looking for things that sort of help us avoid the pain, or we think is going to help us avoid the pain, or is going to help us hold on to pleasure. And then we end up forming views around these experiences. So, yeah, it's kind of exhausting when I think about it, because I think you're constantly oscillating, you're constantly reacting then, because if you're seeking pleasure and you're avoiding pain, there's an ongoing reaction, isn't there, or there's an ongoing search, and it's kind of, it's exhausting, really, in a way. So when we sit in meditation, what we're trying to do, one of the things we're trying to do is just become aware of our reactions. Yeah, when we become aware of our reactions, it's an opportunity to be aware of a view, because behind a reaction is normally some kind of view. But the view is only the beginning. So you might become aware, well, I mean, how many of you, this is, you don't have to admit it if you are, but how many of you had heated conversations about Brexit? I can see from the smiles of quite a few people did. So there's a view there. So that's a kind of obvious view that you knew you probably had. The elections have just gone as well, so there would have been views around that. So these are kind of very specific views. But Buddhism said it's not the view itself that's necessarily the problem. What do we think is the problem if it's not necessarily the view itself? The reactions that come out of that. And why do we react?
Because we're attached to them.
Yeah. Yeah. So we attach ourselves to the view. We have a view. We think, oh, this is what I think. This is how I believe. This is my values. This is, you know, my beliefs about the world. We have a view, but then we attach ourselves to it. And it becomes fundamentally important for us to then perpetuate this view, to keep it going. And it forms part of our sense of my identity, yeah? And that's why, then if a view's challenged, we then feel threatened by that. And that's why conflict develops. Conflict develops in our lives and in the world, generally. So sitting in meditation and just begin to see our reactions, you can do this outside of meditation, absolutely, as well, reflecting on our reactions and just beginning to ask oneself, well, What's the view there? What's the view there? And then if you can identify the view, sometimes they're quite subtle, so it might take a bit of exploration, but if you can identify the view, it might be then, what's keeping me attached to it? What am I afraid of? Because we are afraid of letting go of our views, Yeah, that's why we fight for them. So what do we think will happen if we loosen our set views a bit? So it's a very interesting practice to do that. Certainly I work sometimes in coaching, and I help people, you know, when they're in conflict, and sometimes people are aware of the view they have. You get to the point where you think, okay, this is what I believe, this is what I believe has happened, for example, and there's two opposing views, and that's why there's conflict. And that's a good stage to get to, but it's the beginning, because that you can have a view, but you still think, well, but my view is right, so you must be wrong. And then the conflict just continues, yeah? So you know you're gonna make some progress when both sides, even one side sometimes, begins to loosen their attachment to the view. They're prepared to consider a different way of seeing the situation. And then you know then that there's possibility for change. So really, the short answer to the question is that how do we construct our world? It could be attachment to views. And that's not just our world, it's the world in general. So what do we do? Do we not have views? Could we live without views? No? Why not?
Well, some of them are kind of a compass, and some views are very useful.
Okay, yeah.
To stay alive, yes. Stay healthy, yes. To make friends.
Yeah, some views are really useful to stay alive, you know, to make friends, etc. So some views are useful. Any other reasons?
Buddha had views. Buddhism is a point of view.
So basically, yes, we need views because we need to make a sense of our world. Yeah, we need to make meaning. We need to know how we're going to operate in this world. Yeah.
But as an individual, it's also about a sense of self.
Yeah, it can be about a sense of self as well. So we need to actually, like Buddhism will talk quite a lot about seeing through the self and seeing that there's no fixed self. But sometimes we need to actually get a sense of, well, what is the self I'm imagining that's here even, you know. So what actually produces my feelings and thoughts about the world? And that is a combination of all the things that we've mentioned. So we need to get a sense of self before we can let go of self, you know, see beyond that. But absolutely, we need to make sense of the world that we're in. So we do need views. But what Buddhism is saying is that we need to develop right views, views that are based on the fact that the world is impermanent. Yeah, we are impermanent.
Can I just ask a question about this?
Yeah.
Because, the Buddha, it's an enlightened view that the Buddha sort of came across by sort of experimentation, isn't it? But don't scientists are all wise, there must be like a lot of wisdom across the board in the world, whether it's Buddhism, science. People know this stuff.
So yes, absolutely.
Just Buddhists.
No. I mean, people will know, artists, poets, will be depicting impermanence. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why things are so moving sometimes. If you watch a film or you see a piece of art, there's something just deeply moving about it because it's depicting the fact that we're not here forever. I mean, that's within our experience, isn't it? But what Buddhism says is that it's a that sort of sense of we know things are impermanent. We know things are impermanent, and every now and again we'll see it really clearly when somebody dies, for example. But we don't live that way most of the time. If we really lived in a way that we acknowledged impermanence, we would probably treat ourselves and each other very differently, yeah? And we've certainly got not go about creating the conflicts that we do in the world. So what Buddhism's trying to do is get us to really, taking up that root of suffering, yes? So it's not just an intellectual, conceptual understanding, it's within our whole experience, yeah? Answer that. So right views. So right views, we need to develop right views which are complete, whole, the fuller picture, yes? And views that are conducive to us developing wisdom, to becoming freer. So, Vimalakirti. Back to Vimalakirti. Remember him. So one of the, I said earlier that one of the reasons I like texts like that is because it sort of does break me out of my usual framework. And when I sort of broken out of my usual framework, I began to ask bigger questions, deeper questions. And I'm prepared to allow in more truth. It's a bit like the conflict situation. When you start to loosen something, you allow in new information, a new way of perceiving things. I had an experience of another experience of this when I was in the Caribbean, and we had a total solar eclipse of the sun, and it was quite an incredible experience, and loads of people came from all parts of the world to see it because they knew that they hoped that it would be a perfect view, and it was a perfect view. And it was such a build-up because it's a tiny island I was on. It was just everybody was talking about it, and then as it approached, and we had our goggles, and we learned a bit about the science, about actually what was happening. So it was really exciting. But as it approached, you could feel that some people were getting quite nervous. I think I even was a bit nervous because I thought, how is this? What's going to actually happen? If you're a scientist, you can feel, you can actually explain it probably how it works, because I still don't really know. But basically, what happens in a solar eclipse is that everything starts off as normal. So everything started off, I woke up that morning, the cockerels were singing, the tide was out, it was all just as it normally is. And then approaching, I think it was about 10, 11 o'clock, something started to change in the atmosphere. It was like it was a bright sunny day, and suddenly it started going a little bit overcast. It started going, a few clouds started appearing, and then you started, the cockerels and the animals started reacting and just acting really strange. They started up again, the cockerels started up again, and you're like, why are they, you know, they knew they'd do that at the beginning, and then they, you know, do it the next morning. It was all really strange. And then people had all kinds of views about what was happening. So the scientists were there, you know, really excited about the phenomena that was about to happen. The religious people, and there are many religious people on the island, the churches were full, they were praying for a miracle to happen on the island in their lives, that somehow this was a sign that a miracle would happen. Some people barricaded themselves into their home because they thought that the world was going to come to an end. I was just like, oh my gosh, this is a cosmos, you know. I was already a Buddhist, so I kind of thought, this is just, you know, I'm just going to experience something amazing. And I did, actually. It was completely incredible, because what no one could predict was how the emotional impact it would have. And certainly I felt there's a higher states of consciousness that you can access in meditation called dhyana. And I certainly felt in dhyana for days afterwards. I definitely was not in an ordinary state of consciousness. And the island itself, people were just so... I mean, it's a very friendly island anyway, normally, but people were just loving. It was just... people were singing down the streets and sort of embracing. It was a really tangible feeling it had. So basically, we all, sort of a collective breaking out of our normal framework. And as a result, we could be much more open to the mystery. I think that's what it is. Even if you were a scientist, it was like you couldn't, even if you knew, understood exactly what was happening, you couldn't avoid the sort of mystery of it somehow. So we need that. We need to do that. And the Mahayana text, so this is the original Vimalakirti text, you can see it's well thumbed, that reading it sort of has that impact in a certain way. So we can nurture it, we can call it to us. I mean, we're doing the Metta Bhavana, the mindfulness of breathing. We cultivate the conditions whereby we can be receptive to our experience much more. And then putting ourselves in other conditions, such as exposing ourselves to a text or immersing ourselves in the Dharma in that way, also has that effect. So I'm going to read a bit towards the end, but I just wanted to say the other thing is that when you hear texts like that, they don't necessarily automatically make sense all the time. As I said, it's paradoxes. It's a bit like if you heard of Zen koans. So a Zen koan is a kind of puzzle and a riddle. So a really famous one is what is the sound of one hand clapping? And how that would happen, I've never done formal Zen practice, but how I understand it happens is the master, the Zen master, gives the student a Zen, this is your koan, what's the sound of one hand clapping? And you're supposed to come to the master with your answer after you've meditated on it. So what happens, apparently, is that you sort of conceptually try and work it out, yes? You kind of go, okay, what's the sound of hand clapping? Well, it could be this and it could be that. And you think, and finally think, right, I've got the answer. And then you go to your Zen master who just shakes his head, you know, in dismay, and then sends you off again. And that happens again and again and again and again until you're feeling real, like a real utter sort of failure. And then at some stage, apparently, you sit in meditation and you think, I just don't know anymore. I just don't know. And the mind, your conceptual mind, relaxes. Meanwhile, you have been reflecting on it for months, even years, weeks, months, days, even years, some people. So in a way, you've built up a real understanding in some ways, but you still haven't got there. And then the mind just relaxes and thinks, you know what, I just don't know. And it's then that the truth emerges. And then you go to your Zen master and you give him the thing that emerged. Maybe you give him the don't know, and then you give him the thing that emerged, and then he bows to you. So that's the sort of the Zen practice. So I've not done that practice. It sounds exciting, but I also think it's probably really frustrating, actually. But I have personal koans. I have things in my life, and you may have things in your life where you think, I don't really know what to do. If I go this way, this might happen, and if I go backwards, then that's going to happen, and you feel stuck somehow, because that's what happens. You in a koan, you kind of feel like there's no movement, and you feel stuck. And in that, if you're meditating, if you're reflecting, if you're recognizing as well that there's somewhere in this stuckness of views, yeah, if you recognize that, and if you can get beneath that, well, something relaxes as well. Something relaxes, and you think it's not this and it's not that. You transcend the paradox completely. You transcend those poles completely, and you find a new way. And that certainly happened in my life. I think, well, it's not this. I thought it was that. I didn't think it was that, but I was oscillating between the two, and it was something completely different. So that's how Zen koans work, and that's kind of how these texts work as well. So we want to let go. First, before we let go, we need to identify what some of our wrong views are. Yeah, what are our wrong views? And again, you'll have a sense of a wrong view if you're holding on to it very tightly. If it's causing reaction, if it's causing polarization, and it might be the view's wrong, but it could also be our attachment to the view. Yeah, maybe we're holding on to it very, very tightly. The Buddha said, even a right view, if held on very, very tightly, can actually be unskillful, can be unhelpful. So you might have had an experience in meditation, for example. You might think, I totally understand this now. I've had this amazing experience. I understand this truth. This is the way to do it. I need to tell everybody that this is the way to do it. And if you're doing it differently to me, then you're obviously doing it a bit wrong. You know, that is a wrong view. Yeah. So we need to immerse ourselves in the Dharma, get to know the Dharma, so we can begin to understand our wrong views. Interacting with practitioners is really important, because other people can sometimes help us point out the views that we might have. We might not be that conscious of it, so somebody else might go, well, that's interesting. What makes you think that? Yeah. And again, that really helps us. So Sangha is really crucial for us actually understanding our views more. So the teachings, the Sangha, and obviously we need a teacher. We need somebody who's more experienced than us as well, our equivalent, Sri Ratna's equivalent, if you like, of the Zen master, who can actually help us, point us, well, how about trying this? Or have you thought about that? That's kind of more Sri Ratna's style, I think. And we need, obviously, faith. We need some faith, we need some receptivity to do that. So Vimalakirti, I said that he's very compassionate to all beings. He goes into schools, the brothels. It really doesn't matter to him. He wants to help people see more clearly. He wants to help people wake up to become liberated. But I also said earlier that he's quite challenging to his fellow practitioners. Yes? And there's like two whole chapters in the text where Vimalakirti's sick. So he thinks, I'm sick, but the advanced practitioners, they haven't come to visit me. And then the Buddha understands that that's what Vimalakirti is thinking. So he says, the Buddha then says to the advanced practitioners, hey, you need to go and see Vimalakirti. And they go, I'm really reluctant to. And one by one, they go, I really don't want to. And it's because they sort of describe these episodes. Well, I was sitting meditating, thought I was doing really well. Vimalakirti asked me what I was doing, I explained what I was doing, and he pointed out something much broader, much more expansive, much deeper. He helped them let go of the view, the smaller view they were having. And it's not that they found, you get the sense, I mean, it's pages and pages in the text of this, and you get the sense that it's not that he was harsh really at all, it's more that they're still taking in the impact of his teachings. They're still kind of, it's still reverberating in their being, the impact of his teaching is also the impact of the interaction they've had with him. They're still sort of almost reframing their world based on what he said. It's very interesting. So what Vimalakirti really stands for, I think, is that there's no real settling down, yes? So whether you've been meditating for a few weeks, if you've been meditating for a few weeks, then great, it's a whole new sort of path, a journey that's opened up. But you may be meditating for a few years. And then it can be very easy to think, oh, I think I've got it. I think I've got it now. You know, I'm sort of a bit happier. I'm a bit happier. I'm getting on with people better. I sort of understand the ethical thing a bit. You know, so it can be quite easy. I just keep doing what I'm doing. And what Vimalakirti stands for is, that's great, and there's more. And to get to know that there's more, you need to go deeper. So, I had a friend say to me recently she said, I just feel that the more I practice, the less in control I feel. the less in control. But she said it. I mean, I'm using that face. She didn't say that face, actually. She actually said it with a massive smile on her face. I hadn't seen her that happy before, actually. I thought, that's quite interesting. She's somebody that has a really responsible job. She has to be, because of the nature of her job, has to be in control quite a lot of the time. But she was experiencing a loosening of control, which was actually, for her, a loosening of her kind of construct and restrictive framework that she'd had herself and her life in. So the actual effect of this losing control, if you like, was really positive. She was much more positive. She felt freer. She felt more able to express herself, less inhibited. And she felt she cared about herself and others more, just from loosening the grip, her sort of conceptual grip, if you like. So yeah, we don't know how it's going to impact on us if we keep practicing, but what we do know, and certainly practitioners down the ages can tell you, what we do know is that it increases freedom, a sense of freedom. If you're practicing well, you know, with others, and you're adhering, you're really trying to develop right view. So any questions on that before I conclude? Okay, so I'm going to conclude now. So yes, we've sort of moved from a world that is a slightly a complex world, a very complex world of lots of layers, societal layers, layers of family, where we grew up, our religion, lots of factors influencing the way we perceive our world. And that doesn't include the meanings we make of all those things. Remember, we all make, two people can have a very similar experience, grew up in the same family, in the same street, even roughly at a similar time, and can have still radical different ways of experiencing the world. So we've started our journey with that sort of multi-layered way of experience, our conditioning, which is multi-layered, and we've seen that underneath that there were these existential views, yes, existential views that actually are incomplete or one-sided. And we've seen that if we can see those views and absorb ourselves in the Dharma, sort of interact with other practitioners who are also doing that, we'll be able to identify them a bit more, understand why we're so attached to them, maybe loosen our attachment to those views, and then begin to embody right views. So that's what we've seen. But that doesn't end there. Where it ends, it doesn't actually end. That's the thing, it doesn't actually end. We go from wrong views to gradually right views to then ultimately, and I say ultimately, no views. And it's like the image I have of no views is like imagining a world with lots of wrong views is a heavy world, if you like, lots of clouds, yes, all on top of each other. That's how I see a world of heavy views, wrong views. And then as it clears, the clouds begin to dissipate, and you begin to see more blue emerging. And then ultimately, there are no clouds at all. Ultimately, it's a clear blue sky with a sort of sun radiating. And that sun is the sun of love. Because when there are ultimately no views, love is the response. It's the enlightened being's response to the world, a world that is seeing others very, very clearly as we are. So I'm going to end with a little excerpt from this. So you can sit in your postures if you like, and it's from the chapter called The Goddess. Thereupon, Manjushri, the crown prince, addressed the Lichaveen Vimalakirti. Good sir, how should a bodhisattva regard all living beings? Vimalakirti replied, Manjushri, a bodhisattva should regard all living beings as a wise man regards a reflection of the moon in water, or as the magicians regard men created by magic. He should regard them as being like a face in a mirror, like the water of a mirage, like the sound of an echo, like a mass of clouds in the sky, like the previous moment of a ball of foam, like the appearance and disappearance of a bubble of water, like the core of a planting tree, like a flash of lightning, like the fifth great element, like the seventh sense medium, like the appearance of matter in an immaterial realm, like a sprout from a rotten seed, like a tortoise hair coat, like the fun of games for one who wishes to die, like the egoistic views of a stream winner, like the existence of desire, hatred, and folly in a saint, like thoughts of avarice, immorality, wickedness and hostility in a bodhisattva who has attained tolerance, like the instincts of passions in a Tathagata, like the perception of colour in one blind from birth, like the inhalation and exhalation of an ascetic absorbed in the meditation of cessation, like the track of a bird in the sky, like the erection of a eunuch, like the pregnancy of an infertile woman, like the unproduced passions of an emanated incarnation of the Tathagata. Like dream visions seen after waking. Like the passions of one who is free of conceptualizations. Like fire burning without fuel. Like the reincarnation of one who has attained ultimate liberation. Manjushri then asks further, "Noble sir, if a bodhisattva considers all living beings in such a way, how does he generate the great love toward them?" Vimalakirti replied, "Manjushri, when a bodhisattva considers all living beings in this way, he thinks, just as I have realized the Dharma, so should I teach it to living beings. Thereby he generates the love that is truly a refuge for all living beings. The love that is peaceful because it's free of grasping. The love that is not feverish because it's free of passions. The love that is without conflict because it's free of the violence of the passions. The love that is non-dual because it is involved neither with the eternal, external nor the internal. Thereby he generates the love that is firm, its high resolve unbreakable, like a diamond. A love that is pure, purified in its intrinsic nature. The love that is even, its aspirations being equal. The bodhisattva's love that continuously develops living beings. The Buddha's love that causes living beings to awaken from their sleep. The love that is spontaneous because it is fully enlightened spontaneously. The love that has no presumption because it has eliminated attachment and aversion. The love that is great compassion because it infuses the Mahayana with radiance. The love that is never exhausted because it acknowledges voidness and selflessness. The love that is giving because it bestows a gift of Dharma free of the tight fist of a bad teacher. The love that is morality, because it improves immoral living beings. The love that is tolerance, because it protects both self and others. The love that is liberative technique, because it shows the way everywhere. The love that is without formality, because it's pure in motivation. The love that is without deviation, because it acts from decisive motivation. The love that is high resolve because it is without the passions. The love that is without deceit because it is not artificial. The love that is happiness because it introduces living beings to the happiness of the Buddha. Such Manjushri is the great love of a bodhisattva." Thank you. Thank you.